Turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. And while you're doing that, I want you to think about something. When I say the word commitment, what's the first thing that comes into your mind? Just pop it off.
Promise.
Promise.
Dedication.
Yeah, dedication.
Results.
I like that. Mm-hmm.
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice. That's key. So we're going to be talking a little bit about commitment this morning. But it doesn't start there. And I think a good example we have of this is Daniel. It's a very common biblical character. But hopefully we'll dive into it and see something you may have not seen before. Maybe we'll look at it from a little different angle this morning. So yes, commitment. When we think about that, it's something that we all need to have in our lives. We need to be committed to what we believe. I think we all agree with that. But there's a lot of things that go with that. Like Chad said, it's a promise. There's also sacrifice involved. There's dedication. It's very multifaceted. So let's start by reading some of the book of Daniel, starting in chapter 1, and we'll start in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. This isn't a good situation, just right off the bat. This is bad. A bunch of bad guys come, they wipe out Jerusalem, they capture a bunch of people, they steal all the stuff. It's not pleasant. I mean, we've never really experienced what that's like, but just imagine you wake up one day and an invading army just takes everything and kills your family. Not good at all. And Daniel's right in the middle of this. So let's move down to verse 4 and then verse 5. And this is part of the king's plan. It's a little unusual, actually, when we think about it. But verse 4 starts out saying, "Youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, and learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans." Like, this was something the king wanted done with these young men that they've captured. Again, it's kind of strange. So first of all, you've lost everything. Your city's been destroyed. You're hauled off a long, long ways away to a place where you don't know the people or the language or the culture or anything. And they're like tapping you on the shoulder. "Oh, by the way, you're coming over here and you're going to be in this school for a couple of years where we're going to like brainwash you," basically. I don't think any of them really enjoyed this a whole lot. And then on down to verse 5, "The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate," so that's good, he's treating them well, "and of the wine that he drank, and they were to be educated for 3 years, taken away from their families, put in the king's palace or his royal area for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to stand before the king." And I'm not sure how familiar you are with world history, but let's just put it this way. King Nebuchadnezzar is not known for being nice. So if you would go stand before him after 3 years of training and you were subpar, well, that's simple, off with your head. So I can imagine these guys are kind of nervous. You know, you want to, like, don't rock the boat, like, just do exactly what they say, and let's just try to get through this together, guys. Like, because these are probably young men who at least knew of each other or had grown up together, and we don't know how many of them that there were. But then the situation starts getting a little more interesting. The story kind of takes a curve off to one side. And you know, as Jews, Daniel and all of these young men that had been captured, as Jews, they had convictions that were very strong. And those convictions were extremely counter to the culture that they lived in, the society that they had been captured in and taken to. And these guys really stood out. It'd be like, Amish in Manhattan. They would stand out. It's about extreme as this would be. The Babylonians, the Jews, completely different people. So they had these convictions. Now, where does it go from there? Well, it starts getting interesting. So Daniel has these convictions, and these young men have these convictions. So out of those convictions come commitment. Okay, so I started with commitment, but I don't think you can really have true commitment unless you have true convictions. I'm pretty sure we can all agree on that. You have to have a strong, true conviction. So out of that's going to come some commitments. Well, what are the commitments? Well, let's look at that. Let's go to verse 8. And this is the first time we get a look into Daniel's character. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Okay, so there's a commitment. He has a conviction, but he's acting on it. He doesn't just say, I have this conviction. I'm committed to it. I'm going to see it through. And remember the context. You don't want to rock the boat. It could be off with your head. So, Daniel, what are you thinking? This is a bad idea. Just drink some wine. It's not that big a deal, you know? No, he has a conviction, and he's going to commit to it. Okay, then down verse 10. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, this is interesting, I fear my lord the king. The eunuch is getting scared. Who assigned your food and your drink? The king assigned this to you. Please do not go against this. It will get us all killed. This is a bad idea. And he says, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than all the youths who are of your own age? There, so you would endanger my head with the king. This guy's getting scared for good reason, probably. He was probably replacing somebody else who'd been killed by the king or something. And then it go down, and then you just keep reading here, and then, let's hop to verse 12. This is what Daniel says. Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to how you see. Now, this is interesting. This shows a lot of faith. I know we've all tried diets and things, but 10 days? I mean, maybe, but I don't know. Like, let's just pretend, Judson, we're going to do a contest. You're going to eat your normal food, and I'm going to eat vegetables and only drink water. And after 10 days, let's see who looks like, you know, super fit and in better condition. But we don't do anything else different. I mean, maybe. It's a little bit of a stretch, though. Daniel's really going out on a limb here. Because he said, if it don't work, we're not going to do it. Well, that's not good, because then that goes against his conviction. Daniel has a lot of faith here to do this. And I think we kind of miss that sometimes. He had to really go out on a limb and say, no, I believe this is the right path, and God's going to come through for me. And so, okay, so verse 14 then. So he, the eunuch, listened to them in this manner and tested them for 10 days. So they actually did it. Now, look at this. Verse 15, at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. Now, what do you see in that verse that's kind of unusual or interesting? I had to read this a couple of times.
It would seem.
Okay. I mean, first off the bat, it worked. That right there is a shock. It's like, oh my, wow, God actually came through for these guys. They had these convictions. They committed to those convictions. God delivered. But what more is here?
Fatter in flesh could be stronger, more muscular.
These guys are getting jacked, yeah. They're fit. They're strong. Yeah.
They're smarter.
Well, that's interesting, since when does eating vegetables make you smarter? I mean, it might help, but I mean, noticeably? Elliot, let's have a competition. You're going to eat pork, I'm going to eat vegetables. At the end of 10 days, let's see who beats on an IQ test. I mean, okay, maybe, but not, I mean, come on, not that big a difference. Not to where someone just watching is like, wow, he's definitely smarter. Like, it's not going to happen. I mean, Elliot's smarter than me anyway. Yeah, there's a couple interesting things, but there's something specific I'm looking for here. These are all really good points, so this is great. But keep going. There's more here.
Better than all.
Than all. Who's the all? Better than who?
I'd say it's the rest of the ones in this test. All the.
Okay. Who's in this test?
The ones who maybe gave up their conviction.
Yeah. Exactly. Out of all these youths, and there wasn't just like 10 of them. There was a lot of youths taken from Jerusalem. How many had these convictions? We don't know. Probably a fair amount. How many committed to those convictions to actually go out on a limb for God? From the text here. Four. That's pretty bad odds. That means there is a lot of young people that Daniel probably grew up with who said, nah. it's not worth rocking the boat. I don't want to lose my head, so I'm just gonna roll with it. I had these convictions as a Jew. I know they would know it's wrong. Don't eat pork. Don't eat these foods, because these are probably foods that have been sacrificed to idols, so it's bad. It's against what God commanded them. But they're like, I know, but I'm not going to do it. That's okay. Like, I have that conviction, but I'm not going to actually commit to it. And out of all those, only four actually committed to it. I find that really, really sad. Really sad. And that's something that we always kind of focus on, how Daniel stood up for it, but, you know, there's a lot who didn't. And we don't know where those other youth ended up, after all of this, but who knows, maybe they just kind of assimilated into society and lost their beliefs and ended up becoming pagan. We don't know. The others maybe had the same convictions because of their common Jewish heritage, but they weren't able to actually commit. But here's where it gets interesting. Okay, so Daniel had this conviction. He's committed to it, so he went out on a limb for God, and God came through for him. Now, here's what's interesting. His commitment transformed his lifestyle. You can't have a true commitment without it actually transforming your lifestyle, at least in some way. And so now we get down into verse 16 and 17. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. They're going totally just vegetarian here. And as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Oh, well, now that's interesting. Have you ever wondered where Daniel got his ability to interpret dreams? Right here. It never mentions that ability until after they've made these commitments to follow God. So if you have convictions and you make commitments to them, it will change your lifestyle. It changed their lifestyle dramatically. Everybody around them would have noticed. I mean, you can't pull this off without somebody being like, well, those guys are weird. I mean, they're eating vegetables when they could be having the best food in the kingdom. Like, that's weird. Oh, wow. But have you noticed that Daniel guy? Like, dude, I had a dream last night. I mentioned it to him, and he totally knew what it was and, like, knew what it meant. Like, people would have started talking, like, wow, this is weird. They eat vegetables, and now they've got all these amazing abilities. Like, they're super smart. Their IQs are way better than before. What is going on? It's kind of funny if you were to think about, if you'd have been in that situation, you would probably have been immensely confused. Like, what's up with these four guys? Something's different. And we know the answer because we can look back and say, God came through for these young men. But it doesn't end there even. The commitment transforms his lifestyle. God blesses Daniel. But there's one more thing. It transforms the people around him. So now we jump to verse 2. And it gets really, really interesting. These convictions carry all the way through. So let's go to chapter 2, verse 46. And this is after, so King Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. As we all know in the story, he dreams this dream. He claims he doesn't know what the dream is, and he's going to kill all the, you know, wise men if they don't, like, deliver, basically. And they're like, oh, wait, this Daniel guy, ever since he started eating vegetables, he can interpret dreams. It's kind of weird, but he can do it, so let's go get him. So they go get him. Daniel interprets the dream perfectly. Verse 46, King Nebuchadnezzar. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel. This is the king of the most powerful nation on the planet, literally bows down before Daniel and says, wow, that's pretty crazy. And commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. It's really interesting. And the king answered and said to Daniel, truly, your God is a God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery. Daniel's convictions turned into commitments that he stood for, even at great personal risk. Those commitments transformed his lifestyle. And because of that transformed lifestyle, he literally changed King Nebuchadnezzar's mind, which was not an easy thing to do at that time. The most powerful man on the planet, all of a sudden saying, wow, your God, Yahweh, your God is the God of gods. That's pretty crazy, because King Nebuchadnezzar did not believe that. But it was Daniel's commitments and his transformed lifestyle, and it showed Nebuchadnezzar, you know what? Your God is the real deal. That's really, really interesting, to go from an exile to in the king's court and literally changing the king's mind about his religion. You know, there these four steps that Daniel took, conviction, commitment, transformed lifestyle, and then transforming the people around him, those bring about enormous amounts of courage. They build an inner anchor in yourself and a formidable internal settledness that is not easily upset, because that is anchored in Jesus and in your convictions. It's not something you just decide on a whim. Daniel didn't just like, oh, I think I believe this. Like, this was deep set convictions that he held to. You know, note, Daniel operated spiritually before strategically. What he did was strategically, that was really stupid. It was a really bad idea. But he said, no, spiritually, this is more important. Now, this is really key here, because living in God's kingdom transcends reason. To the world, the Christian message seems utterly foolish. And this is something we see in 1 Corinthians. You know, the wisdom of God is foolishness to men. As believers, we must be unreasonably committed. Unreasonably committed. We have a higher loyalty than anything else in this world. So let's circle back to that inner settledness of Daniel. Now combine that with unreasonable commitment. It's a very powerful combination. What's the result? Anybody want to guess? For Daniel specifically. Okay, so let's turn to chapter 6. The result of Daniel being really firm in his convictions, like, I believe this, I am committed to it, and I am unreasonably committed. So he's got these very powerful concepts running in his life. The results of those things, chapter 6, he gets thrown into a den of lions. Well, that didn't go so well. Daniel, what are you thinking? You should have just, like, I mean, the king makes a decree, don't pray to your God. Okay, you can keep praying, but just close your doors, man. Like, that's a bad idea. You're going to get killed. And in the whole, okay, let's just read some of this, because this is just a really bizarre story. Like, these things, these commitments, look what he got him, a lion's den. That's not fun. Have anybody been in a lion's den before? No, nobody? I don't think anybody's been in a lion's den and survived. Pretty sure. You ever seen one at a zoo? Hold it. They're scary. Daniel was probably pretty scared, honestly. You know, I mean, he knew what he believed, but it didn't mean that he didn't have a healthy fear of being eaten. You know, he never says anywhere that he was, like, sure God was going to save him. He didn't know if he was going to make it or not. Let's read some of chapter 6. So chapter 6, starting in verse 4. So you have a group of officials, and they sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they couldn't find any fault, basically, because he was faithful. He was committed. Faithful. No error or fault was found in him. So these guys are kind of over a barrel. They want to kick him out of the kingdom, and they can't, because he's just committed to doing what's right. And then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." And then all these officials, they come by agreement to the king, say, "Oh, King Darius, live forever." And then they, like, get him to sign this thing, and it just kind of goes downhill from there. Verse 10, let's see. Now, look at this. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. Now, you want to see unreasonable commitment? That's unreasonable commitment. I mean, it's like a terrorist saying, if you pray and I hear you pray, I will shoot you. And you're like, cool, and you get down on your knees and you pray. Like, that's just, you just don't do it. He is going to die. He would have known, obviously, doing this is a death sentence. There's no way nobody's going to notice. But he's unreasonably committed. Then, verse 14, then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver him. And he labored till the sun went down trying to rescue him. The king really didn't want to kill him, but he didn't have a choice. Moving down to verse 18. The king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. Sleep fled from him. The king is really disturbed about this. He's like, I don't want to throw my best guy into a den of lions, but he's got to. And then, at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. And he came near to the den where Daniel was. He cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Now, this is interesting. Verse 21 is the first time we see Daniel say anything in this whole passage, in the whole story. There's not one word of defense. There's not one word of complaint. There's no trying to change the king's mind. This is the very first words Daniel ever says. Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me because..." Why? Why did they not harm him? "Because I was found blameless before him," before God. "And also before you, O king, I have done no harm." And the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken out of the den. And no harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Verse 23. Unreasonably committed. And then what's really interesting, immediately after this story, King Darius, and we have to remember, so now there's been a kingdom change. King Nebuchadnezzar was Babylonian. King Darius was Persian. Basically, the Persians came through and said, "Hey, we're taking Babylon. It's ours now." And the Persians are one of the biggest, greatest empires in the history of the world. They controlled an immense amount of territory. So after Daniel gets chucked in with some lions, which we're like, "That was dumb, Daniel. I mean, what are you thinking?" His friends probably thought he was totally crazy. "Are you, like, trying to die? Because that's what it looks like." But he was unreasonably committed. God saves him, and as a direct result of that, two verses later, King Darius writes an open letter, and it says, "For all peoples and all nations and all languages," because the Persian Empire was so huge. I mean, I forget the exact proportions at the time. But it's like, think like the Roman Empire. It's massive. He sends it to everywhere, saying, "Hey, everybody needs to worship the God of Daniel." One man making an unreasonable commitment to follow God, even though he knew he would die. He knew that he knew what the cost would be. And the results was an entire nation being told, "Nope, Yahweh is the true God to worship." You know, the Bible is full of unreasonably committed people, giants of faith. You know, David literally took on a giant with a slingshot. I mean, that was a bad idea, you know. Paul, who was so passionate for Christ, he gave up his entire life to travel and spread the gospel. Noah, who built an enormous boat for no apparent reason, all while preaching the end of the world. After 120 years of preaching, how many converts did Noah have? Zero. Unreasonably committed. Peter, who followed in the steps of his master, giving all he had and was ultimately martyred. Jeremiah, who preached repentance to a nation for over 50 years, only to see his homeland destroyed anyway. Unreasonably committed. Job, who watched everything he had be taken away, but still stayed or would not stray from his convictions. Joseph, who was sold as a slave, cast in prison, and falsely accused, yet still was true to God's calling, and as a result, nations were saved from famine. Unreasonably committed. And most of all, kind of like what Zach was saying, Jesus, who didn't turn away from suffering, betrayal, even gruesome torture and death, dying on the cross. Jesus was unreasonably committed to you. Unreasonably committed to you. And he asked the same of us. All of these faced immense challenges for their commitments. How can we be unreasonably committed? Because we have 100% confidence in who Jesus is. That's how we can be unreasonably committed. So, I like to make things visual. So I brought a cardboard box. Now, I promise you, this is a normal cardboard box. There's no gimmicks. Just so you know. So I'm going to set this right by the penny here in a sec. And I'm going to need Justin to come up here. He's already getting scared. All right, so Justin, I need you to walk up here. Are you ready for this? Yeah, he's not sure. Okay, I need you to step inside the box.
Hope that'll fit.
You'll turn your feet sideways or something. All right, you got this? Okay, Justin's inside the box. Yeah, he's definitely in there. Yeah, and y'all can see that, right? Okay. Look at him. He's terrified. He's shaking. Like, look at that. He's going to fall. Archie's scared. now why wasn't Judson scared?
His feet were pretty much on the ground.
Yeah, but they weren't. I mean, he could have followed. I mean, it's a long ways.
He could see what he was encountering.
Okay, he could see it. So he could see, hey, I'm not 20 feet up in the air. Okay. Yeah. Why wasn't Judson scared?
He's on a solid foundation.
Solid foundation? Yeah. I'm looking for a specific phrase. Faith? Judson knew he was safe. He's standing in that box, he knows I'm safe. It's like, I mean, if I fall, like, I mean, you know, really? I mean, it's not scary. Like, seriously, I'm safe. I'm 100% secure, right? You felt pretty secure. Now, sometimes in life, when we go through life, we have trouble being unreasonably committed to Christ because we feel like we're inside this box, like this, and God has us about 100 feet off the ground. And he's just dangling you up there, just waiting for you to trip up. And you're going to fall. And you know what the reality is? This is the reality. Yeah, I mean, you're on a small platform. I mean, it's really small. I'm not sure if I... But I mean, come on. I mean, really, in reality, you are 100% saved. Jesus has you. Yes, there are those valleys of the shadow of death. But you're still secure. That doesn't mean that life's not going to be really hard, but you are still, you're still safe. You're still safe in Jesus. And you know, look at someone like Daniel. That doesn't mean life's going to be all roses. Look at someone like Daniel. He literally got thrown into a den of lions. That couldn't have been fun. But he knew he was safe because he believed in God. Doesn't mean the story always ends nicely, but he knows he can trust in God. And he knows when he stands on that little platform, like, it doesn't worry. It's okay. I'm not going to fall because I'm safe. Am I making sense? Whenever you feel like God just puts you on a little tiny platform and then lifts you 100 feet up in the air, it's not how God works. God's not just doing that and just waiting for you to fall and hurt yourself or die. That's not what God's trying to do. Yeah, but sometimes we have to stand on small pieces and be careful, but we're still safe. That's how we can be 100% committed to Jesus, because we know that God will always come through for us. We know that. You know, who are your heroes in life? Because sometimes we seem to glorify the wrong people, but you know, the people that are the real heroes in life are those who are unreasonably committed to standing for Jesus, even when, for all pretense and purposes, when you look on, it's like, that's not safe. That is not safe what he is doing. That he should not do that. I know you're supposed to follow Jesus, but I mean, come on, it's not safe. And the person who's in it is like, oh, I'm good, because I'm, you know, standing on a piece of cardboard that's about this high off the ground. Like, I'm good. But everybody else looking, I was like, no, it's not safe. There's a story that happened here a couple weeks ago, and I'm sure y'all all heard about it. The missionary who went to that island off the coast of India to bring the gospel to an unreached tribal people group. And everybody said, that's a terrible idea. Don't do it. You're going to die. It's a bad idea. And he said, no, I'm unreasonably committed to Jesus. I feel this calling on my life. So he went. And you know what? They shot him with arrows and he died. Was he ever unsafe? We look at that and say, oh man, that's so, he shouldn't have done that. But you know what? God still had control of that situation. There's another situation we're facing right now in Iraq. One of our team is being pressed charges for the work we're doing, trying to help some of those people. And the community is fighting back, and she has to go stand before a judge Monday or Tuesday. They're en route right now. Had to buy an emergency plane ticket. And you know what? She'll probably sit in jail in an Iraqi prison because she was unreasonably committed to what God had called her to. Unreasonably committed. I mean, look at those situations like, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. That's scary. That's a bad idea. No, that person is totally safe because they are right in God's will. We can be unreasonably committed because our convictions are completely sure. Our foundation transcends our feeble, temporal, finite understanding of this world. If our foundation is sure, just like that floor wasn't going to give out on you, Judson, and you knew you could trust it. If our foundation is sure, our convictions rooted in Jesus, we cannot be shaken because we are founded on something that cannot be shaken. Because the worst evil Satan can conjure up cannot possibly touch the sure foundation of our conviction, which is within the person of Jesus Christ himself. I'm going to end with two quotes. I just read these yesterday from a person who was a missionary in Afghanistan. Very brutal place, very hard, often unsafe in our perspective. And she said, there is often a gulf between what we say we believe and what we actually believe. We like to say, oh yeah, we know we're secure in Christ. But it's easy to say that, but do you actually believe it? Are your commitments sure and true? For Daniel, the gulf between what he said he believed and what he actually believed, it didn't exist. They were one and the same. He said it, and he actually believed it. And one last quote. Who we follow really does make a difference. Really does. Who are you following? Are you following Jesus? Or are you following your own self?